Today is Friday, February 1st, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Lori London is off today. Coming up, President Trump is optimistic on reaching, quote, the biggest deal ever made with China. A majority of Americans blame the president for the recent government shutdown. His supporters hope he learned a lesson.
He's fearless. I mean, he's fearless in a way that I've seen few people in politics be fearless. But when you act on impulse and you don't have a plan sometimes, as I think what happened with the shutdown, it doesn't end well.
Also ahead, the U.S.-North Korean nuclear talks are making only limited progress. It's all in today's International Edition. U.S. and China negotiators continued their second round of trade negotiations on Thursday, with President Trump expressing optimism a deal will get done before the March 1st deadline. Joining me is VOA's senior White House correspondent, Patsy Witakaswara. Patsy, what are some of the key issues the two sides are working on?
Well, essentially, there are three big areas. The first one is intellectual property. As we know, the U.S. accuses Beijing of stealing from American firms, forcing them to transfer technology to China. That's one big issue. And then the second one is, of course, market access. The U.S. is accusing Beijing of limiting access to China. And the third is just this industrial roadmap by China, which is called Made in China 2025, which could be the biggest stumbling block because it rankles the U.S., which sees it as a direct challenge to American supremacy in sectors such as aerospace, semiconductors, and 5G. So because of these three big issues that are hanging over the negotiations, administration officials have signaled that we might be able to achieve a more narrow deal that could stave off additional tariffs, but to not roll back the duties on the $250 billion worth of Chinese imports that President Trump has already imposed. And in exchange, China would perhaps follow through with some purchases of American goods and services and some modest economic changes. That's as far as I know the negotiations going on today.
There certainly are a lot of things on the table. Mr. Trump is saying this will be a big deal. Does China see it the same way?
Well, perhaps the clearest indication would be the letter that President China Xi Jinping sent to President Trump. It was delivered by his vice premier, Liu He, who met with President Trump today at the White House. Basically, the letter is asking President Trump to meet halfway. It was a very conciliatory letter, and President Trump read it in front of everybody and said that it was a beautiful letter. So this is, of course, something that both sides want. The tariffs are not helping anybody because with the status of the world economy and both of the economies so intertwined with each other, hurting your enemy with tariffs is also hurting yourself.
Well, the letter that you mentioned and letters from other leaders really depict how President Trump negotiates based on relationships. Do you think that's going to work in this sort of trade negotiation?
Yes, that's true. And we've seen that with a number of world leaders, including Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin and also President Xi Jinping, whom President Trump met last December at the G20 in Argentina. The problem with relying a lot on these personal relationships, experts say, is that if it's just based on a gut reaction, if it's not based on clear parameters of what must be achieved, if there's no verifiable indications of what success means, then it's just summetry, then it's just theater. So this is a thing that a lot of administration officials have expressed concern about, that a deal would be met with the substance that is required.
Well, what happens if a deal isn't reached by the March 1st deadline?
The U.S. has said that it will increase the tariff. Right now it's 10%. It will be increased to 25%. This is on Chinese goods of about $200 billion. And the president has also threatened tariffs on an additional $270 billion worth of Chinese products. So there's definitely going to be a ramping up of pressure on both sides. No doubt the Chinese will retaliate as well. So this March 1st deal, whether it is achieved or not, whether the deadline will be extended or not, as President Trump have somewhat hinted in today's talks, We'll just have to see on in terms of what has been achieved or what can be achieved by the two sides negotiating yesterday and today.
VOA Senior White House Correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara, thanks for joining us on VOA's International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido is accusing security forces of threatening his family. President Donald Trump says he will bring home all American troops from Afghanistan if there is a peace deal with the Taliban. Europe starts a new finance mechanism to bypass U.S. trade sanctions on Iran. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials in Arizona say they've made their biggest fentanyl bust ever. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists led by Johan Brox, an associate professor at the Australian National University, recently studied some fat molecules they had found on an ancient fossil. They say their studies provided evidence that allowed them to identify the fossil animal as a Dickinsonia and that it is the earliest known animal in the geological record. The scientists say the creature lived on Earth about 558 million years ago, which was about 20 million years before the so-called Cambrian explosion of modern animal life. Brox described this event as a time when complex animals and other life forms, like mollusks, worms, sponges, and arthropods, took over the fossil record. Brox and his colleagues described this primitive animal as being oval-shaped with rib-like structures along its body and measuring about 1.4 meters in length. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Washington, congressional negotiators only have until February 15th to find a solution or risk the prospect of the U.S. government being shut down again. In an interview with the New York Times today, Mr. Trump called the talks a waste of time. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
Government workers back on the job in Washington after the longest shutdown in U.S. history. The affected agencies reopened after President Trump and opposition Democrats agreed to work toward a compromise on border security. Trump issued a fresh warning on Twitter that any agreement must include funding for a border wall, following up on a vow he made when the shutdown ended last week.
The government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
But there appears to be little appetite for another shutdown among Republicans, including Senate Leader Mitch McConnell.
I don't like shutdowns. I don't think they work for anybody, and I hope they'll be avoided.
Opinion polls found that the public largely blamed Trump and Republicans for the shutdown, something Democrats like Senator Chuck Schumer have eagerly pointed out.
I hope this serves as a lesson to President Trump and all of my Republican colleagues. No more shutdown. President Trump touched a hot, hot stove, and hopefully he won't do it again.
Several polls show the president's approval rating dipped below the 40% range as the shutdown dragged on, suggesting possible long-term damage for Trump. Brookings analyst Elaine Kmark.
It looks like we've hit a turning point of sorts. The president severely misjudged the effects of the shutdown on ordinary people. Nobody in that White House really truly understood how important federal government functioning was to the whole American economy.
So we're going to do it, and we're doing well.
Some Trump supporters hope the president learned a lesson from the shutdown impasse, and they expect him to rebound, including former Governor Chris Christie.
He's fearless. I mean, he's fearless in a way that I've seen few people in politics be fearless. And so those are all good points. But when you act on impulse and you don't have a plan sometimes, as I think what happened with the shutdown, it doesn't end well.
Given the shutdown's unpopularity, many Trump supporters expect the president to declare a border emergency to build the wall if Congress fails to find a compromise. The campaign promise of a wall is just too important, says analyst John Fortier.
And it was a slogan on the campaign trail. This is something that he doesn't want to be seen as completely capitulating on, and that makes it very tough to compromise.
Donald J. Trump. On the other hand, Trump could weaken his own reelection hopes by his singular focus on pleasing his core supporters, says Elaine Kamar.
He has not tried in his 2 years in office to expand his base. That's a disaster for a president, because inevitably some of your base is going to peel away.
Mr. Speaker!
The president's next best opportunity to make his case on a border wall is Tuesday's State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress and a national television audience. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
A day after President Trump lashed out at U.S. intelligence agency chiefs over their assessments of global threats, he abruptly reversed course Thursday and said that he and the intelligence community are all on the same page. Joining me to help us understand is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Jeff, what changed in the last 24 hours?
Well, the president had a meeting late Thursday afternoon with some of his top intelligence officials, including Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats and CIA Director Gina Haspel. And they had a conversation. And after that meeting in the White House, in the Oval Office, the president, from his @RealDonaldTrump Twitter account, tweeted out that he just concluded a, quote, great meeting with my intel team, end quote. And he said that they said that the worldwide threats hearing in the Senate on Tuesday, when they talked a lot about the Islamic State, when they talked about North Korea, about Iran, he said in his tweet that they told him what was reported of that public hearing that was televised was, quote, mischaracterized by the media and, quote, was distorted by the press. And then he blames the media for a false narrative and says, quote, we had a very good meeting and we are all on the same page. It is unclear what exactly transpired between the hearing on Tuesday, the Wednesday tweets from the president in which he insulted his intelligence people, specifically on their testimony regarding Iran, and said that they should go back to school, calling them passive and naive, and this meeting late Thursday with the Director of National Intelligence and the CIA director. But that's where we are right now. When asked for comments about what happened, the CIA declined comments and would not say anything more about how one day the president could be tweeting that the intelligence chiefs were wrong, and the next day they're all on the same page.
I want to talk to you about another story. NBC is reporting on a draft report from the Pentagon, and this report shares some disturbing information on the Islamic State, right?
Yes, the NBC says that it's talked to officials who have seen a draft report that's expected to come out sometime next week as part of a quarterly report that the Department of Defense Inspector General puts out on Operation Inherent Resolve, which is the name of the operation for the U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria fighting against the Islamic State terror group. And the report says what the Pentagon assesses is that without continued pressure on Islamic State in Syria, that the terror group would be capable of reclaiming territory in anything from 6 to 12 months. And this goes into the ongoing tensions between the Pentagon and the White House over U.S. policy in Syria. The president in December announced that the battle against Islamic State was won, that Islamic State was, quote, beaten and beaten badly, and that it was time for the U.S. troops in Syria to come home, and he was ordering that to happen right away. The disagreement over that caused then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to ultimately hand in his resignation and quit. And since then, some equipment has come out of Syria, but for the most part, U.S. troops have remained, and there have been lots of questions about how the U.S. moves forward. The Islamic State caliphate, the territory it controlled, is almost completely wiped out because U.S.-backed forces have been making consistent advances, and both intelligence and defense officials have said in the next couple of weeks, the Islamic State will not control any territory in Syria. But of course, what the report, the draft report, is talking about and refers to is the fact that the Defense Department's own numbers, its own intelligence estimates, say in Syria alone, there are anywhere from 13,000 to 15,000 Islamic State fighters still there, still coordinating with each other and ready to take up arms. And previous reports and previous defense official comments have suggested that many of these fighters are not even in areas where the U.S.-backed forces are fighting. They're in areas controlled by the Syrian regime, and by Russian or Iranian forces. So there's a whole bunch of concern about what happens if the U.S. takes its pressure off, and the only way to pressure Islamic State in Syria is perhaps with airstrikes that are coming from other parts of the Middle East or occasional incursions by U.S. forces or U.S.-backed forces from Iraq.
For the latest on these stories and other national security issues, you can follow Jeff on Twitter. Jeff, give us again your Twitter account.
My Twitter account is at jseldin, S-E-L-D-I-N.
Jeff Seldin, thank you so much for your insight. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Next month, President Trump and Korean leader Kim Jong-un are expected to hold a second summit. Denuclearization is at the center of any potential agreement between the two countries. Joining me is VOA's Bill Gallo. Bill, Washington's North Korean envoy spoke today about the negotiations. What did he have to say?
I would say the big headline from this public speech by Steve Biegun was that the U.S. has not made significant progress in its nuclear talks with North Korea. However, he was optimistic about there being progress made ahead of the possible anticipated second summit between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. He just pretty much flatly said things are not going exactly as we hoped they would, but he expects concrete and real progress at the next summit.
Well, President Trump has talked often about all the progress that has been made since the last summit in June in Singapore. Has there been any real progress made at this point?
Well, you know, there's always things going on behind the scenes that we can't see. So sometimes it's hard to see, but it also seems pretty clear that Donald Trump at times, and even very frequently, overstates the progress that's being made in things like this. Most recently, that appeared to be the case when Trump's own intel officials said in an intelligence report to Congress this week that North Korea appears to have no intention of giving up its nuclear weapons because it sees them as essential for the survival of its regime. Of course, that's an assessment that Donald Trump disagrees with. Steve Biegun also said today that he thought that those remarks were taken out of context. He said that, look, they're not being naive. The White House knows that North Korea has nuclear weapons. It's just hoping that somehow it can change the calculation and eventually get North Korea to decide to give those weapons up.
Okay, well, negotiators will be in Seoul next week. What is the goal of those meetings?
I think it's really to make a plan forward for all this. Biegun today in his comments talked about a roadmap. He wants some sort of concrete understanding for what will be accomplished at this next summit. Because, as he mentioned, there's not any real purpose in talking just for talking's sake. You know, talking does represent progress in some ways, but if we're not talking about how to get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons, that, of course, is not as valuable of discussion for the United States.
And that's VOA's Bill Gallo. I'm Jim Bertel, sitting in for Lori London on International Edition. A new research project in South Korea aims to uncover the link between North Korea and various European communist secret agencies following the end of World War II. Joining me from Seoul is VOA correspondent Steve Miller. Steve, what can you tell us about this project?
Well, Jim, this is actually a joint project being carried out by the Citizens Alliance for North Korea Human Rights here in Seoul and the Institute for National Remembrance, the Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation, or IPN, actually in Poland. And the IPN is actually an organization that archives the records of secret police files and actually also belongs to a network of like agencies that includes the countries of the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, Germany, and Bulgaria. And they're really charged with archiving all of these records that were carried out under the secret police agencies of the communist era Eastern Bloc countries. Now, the IPN is also in contact with other agencies to try and move this research project forward. Now, the goal is to actually document North Korean interaction with communist secret police agencies following the end of World War II. And according to Joanna Hosniak, who is one of the authors and the deputy director general of the Citizens Alliance for North Korean Human Rights, she says that this project is actually aimed toward North and South Korean youth who are interested in processing information in the effort of truth-seeking, truth-telling, memorialization, and seeking justice.
You've already covered a lot of the issues brought up by this research, but what else have the researchers uncovered?
Well, they uncovered a lot. I mean, there were thousands of pages of documentation that they had access to through the IPN, but there were really two things that were really standing out among their findings. And one is a set of records that really shed some light on the some 1,500 to 1,700 Korean War orphans that were actually sent to Poland during the Korean War. Now, they aged and ranged from as young as 7 to some were actually in their 20s. And what they were able to find through these records is that these youths were enrolled in vocational schools and then sent back to North Korea to try and apply their skills. Now, researchers assume that this may have been a larger part to try and mobilize the Eastern European countries to help with the Korean War effort by educating these youths in Europe to then go back and apply their skills. However, what is not known is actually what happened to these youths once they got back into North Korea. But this finding is really important because North Korea is also accused of large-scale civilian abductions, and this may illuminate some of what Pyongyang's practices are in this regard. And abducting civilians is, of course, also considered a crime against humanity. Now, the second thing that was very interesting in terms of their findings was that there's a lot of documentation pertaining to U.S. and British prisoners of war during the Korean War. What they show is very detailed accounts on who these individuals were. But the interesting thing is that all of these individuals that were in the documentation were of Polish origin. So it showed a very close relationship between North Korean secret police and their Polish counterparts.
All right. Thanks, Steve. And you're listening to International Edition from VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. With a planned U.S. troop pullout from Syria, the French government suggests it may soon repatriate French jihadists held in the Middle Eastern nation. But the idea is deeply divisive at home. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA.
Speaking Tuesday to the French Parliament, Interior Minister Christophe Castaner said if any French jihadists are expelled from Syria, the government will know who they are and where they are located, and they would be arrested and tried the minute they set foot in France. The government has not officially confirmed media reports that as many as 130 French jihadists now held in Syria may be coming home in the near future. France was among Europe's top exporters of jihadists to Syria and Iraq. Many of the hundreds of French who fought with Islamic State and other extremist groups died in battle. Some returned, including several behind the Paris and Brussels terrorist attacks. But officials today estimate about 250 French continue fighting in Syria, according to news reports, and dozens are held in the north by Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. Until now, France has done little to bring them home, but the void left by departing U.S. troops raises concern about their fate.
Ce sont des gens qui ont été nourris par la France.
Some French politicians are adamantly opposed to fighters returning home. That's the case of conservative lawmaker Guillaume Pelletier, who told RMC Radio that those who burned their French passports, committed war crimes, and possibly crimes against humanity have no place in France.
Ils sont détenus aujourd'hui par des groupes qui ont vocation.
But another leading conservative, Christian Estrosi, fears that groups now holding French radicals may be dissolved and the fighters risk going free. Experts warn that returning fighters and other radicals already here may present ticking time bombs, including those now in French prisons, some of whom may be released in just a few years. For VOA, I'm Lisa Bryant in Paris.
On January 27, 1945, as World War II neared its end, Soviet troops liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau, the largest Nazi concentration and death camp. As the emaciated survivors were freed, the scope of the Nazi genocide became undeniable. VOA's Marissa Melton reports that shrinking public awareness of the Holocaust has forced activists to find new ways to help people understand the breadth and gravity of the genocide.
The current slogan on the website for the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is "Choose to Remember." But studies done in Canada and in the United States over the past 2 years indicate that North Americans are starting to forget. In 2018, a study found that only one-third of Americans personally knew or knew of a Holocaust survivor. Meanwhile, the Anti-Defamation League reports the number of anti-Semitic attacks in the United States rose 57% in 2017 over the year earlier. Activist and author Thomas Harding is the descendant of a German-Jewish family who emigrated to Britain in the 1930s, leaving behind a lakeside home on the outskirts of Berlin. His family and the villagers of Grossglienicke, where the house is located, are working to turn the building into an education center. As the survivors of the war years die, Harding says there is a growing need to teach people about the cost of prejudice and persecution.
We've lost that kind of face-to-face, or we're losing that face-to-face connection. And so one of the tasks that we have, I think, is to remind people of what's happened, of the causes and the results of prejudice, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia.
Harding has researched the life of the house and its inhabitants who survived World War II, the Russian occupation of Berlin, the division of the Berlin Wall, and the upheaval of German reunification. Less than 10 meters from the Berlin Wall, the house, now known as Alexander House, had a front row seat. He says when visitors hear those stories in the space where they happened, it helps them understand how those events affected everyday people.
And we're very much using the lessons of the past in a very physical way, because we have this small house which, with its fabric still there, which can tell the stories of the Holocaust, but also of the period during the Cold War. The Berlin Wall went through between the house and the lake, and the Russians occupied the gardens at the end of the Second World War. The Berlin airlift happened there. There's all these extraordinary stories.
Harding says visitors often seem to have a moment where they just get it. They look out over the lake with mature trees lining the shore and the steeple of the village church just across the water, and they just stop and think about things. Harding says student groups have been especially receptive.
And I've been impressed by how they've been able to take those lessons from the past and to apply them to today's world, whether it be about newly arrived refugees in Germany or the rise of anti-Semitism or attacks against Muslims in Europe and North America.
Alexander House is still undergoing renovation, but it can be visited by guided tour. Its organizers hope to complete the renovations and a seminar building on the grounds later this year. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. My thanks to our studio team, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Carl Starling, and I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great weekend.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.